KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's in rain tomorrow, the high reaching 57.
Spirit Halloween stores nationwide are tracking sales of the candidates' masks. The guy whose masks sold the best won the election the first four times, going back to 1996.
For the third consecutive day, Mitt Romney stands at 49% and President Obama at 48%. A statistically insignificant difference in a race that continues to be very tight.
If you've seen a picture of the foil, it was folded seven times and then stored in an envelope for 140 years.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. We'll be talking about that tinfoil recording from 1878 that has been restored in just a few minutes. But first, polling, unofficial polls of how many masks are selling, or all the other polls that are out in the news. There's a lot of attention paid to the presidential polls, but how do we actually know which polls to believe if they're all saying different things? Private firms, media companies, universities, they're all churning out a steady stream of polls this election season. And with little over a week left in the presidential campaign, they've kicked it into high gear. Now about 20 state and national polls are coming out every single day. So how much of it is just noise? Joining us to talk about it is John Cohen. He is the Washington Post polling director. Hi, John.
Hi, good to be with you.
So first things first, a lot of listeners are probably thinking, why follow polls anyway? Are they important or telling us anything?
Certainly the well-done ones are telling us a lot. A well-constructed poll will tell you plus or minus, as they say, and we can talk about that. You know, kind of roughly where the status of the race is, and people are curious about that and, you know, want to follow this presidential election, which means so much to so many in this country, and so their polls are one way of kind of gauging the ups and downs, but it's far more than just the horse race. I mean, good polls will ask several to many questions that go beyond kind of just who's winning, but kind of the candidate attributes that are in play, the issues that voters think are important. All of that helps us understand, you know, the national election, which is so important to all of us.
Yeah, there was even a poll I saw that came out over the weekend that was trying to gauge how racist a country we are in our voting.
Exactly, and that was a poll that used kind of a test of implicit racism to kind of get people that they said that maybe people won't, you know, declare that they're prejudiced, although our experience is that there are many people in this country who are perfectly willing to say that they're prejudiced against one group or another. Some researchers at Stanford University and the Associated Press got together, and the National Opinion Research Council, NORC, to kind of gauge how racist, the racist sentiments people would make toward African Americans, and found that that level was basically just as prevalent now as it was in 2008 before Obama was elected.
Yeah, and the thought was that with a black president, we would change our opinion.
That was an opinion that there's certainly a hypothesis that some people had initially. I think that was pretty well disproved early on in his presidency. And so I think that, you know, even if you ask people without, you know, trying to gauge what they think beyond what they say, there are few people, at least in the public opinion polls that we've done, who say that race relations are better in this country than they were 4 years ago, or that things have improved on that score, you know, over the last few years. So I don't think it's a particularly surprising finding. You know, the real surprise was, you know, the number that they came out with, that 51% of Americans harbor some anti-African-American prejudice. And I think there's a lot of dispute about the accuracy of that number itself, but certainly it remains in their data as widespread as it was 4 years ago.
I wanted to talk about this article you wrote earlier this month about the five myths of political polls, and actually go through the article into what to look at polling through these five myths. So let's talk about your first one, which is that a lot of people believe that a campaign's internal polls are more accurate than public ones. Is that true or not true?
Well, certainly it's a myth. I think it's a widely held notion that campaigns somehow have the most accurate data out there. They do have a lot on the line, which is one of the reasons some people think they have better data, but they don't, and nor are they really reliable interpreters of the public data that are out there. They are, you know, kind of basically on record, one in particular, but they all will say this, is that they use public opinion data, you know, kind of that are most advantageous to their own side. John Edwards, former pollster, referred to using some public polls as propaganda for the campaign. It's just that they are in a campaign. They have different, they're conducting polls for different reasons. In many cases, they're doing public opinion polls to test certain messages that the campaign might want to use. They also want to know the status of the race, but that may be incidental to the major effort that they're putting in. So, you know, kind of you always should look for, you know, public sources that are transparent about their methodologies, about the questions they ask, and about how they interpret their numbers. And you may disagree with them, but, you know, at least it's out there and they give you the means to understand what they did and how they got the answers. And you rarely get that with the internal polling.
Do you have a sense of, if a person wanted to go look at one right now that you would consider accurate, some suggestions that they would go to?
Well, I think there's some really good sites that aggregate polls. The one that I turn to most frequently is pollster.com, which is now part of the Huffington Post family of media companies. But the pollster, you know, kind of catalogs every poll that comes out, both national and state. And one of the features that I like about pollster, as opposed to kind of some other sites that just, you know, simply list the polls, is you can really break apart polls by how they were conducted. So one of the biggest things, the biggest controversies in polling now is kind of how to actually conduct the surveys. And so on pollster.com, you can see which ones were conducted using landline telephones only, which ones include cell phone samples, which has become increasingly critical when you want to look at, you know, America's voters, you know, particularly in certain states, but certainly across the country, where more than one in three adults has abandoned conventional telephone service. So looking at the ones that offer cell phone interviews and kind of how they do that, which ones are based on internet, and there are different flavors, of course, of internet polling, some more representative of the voting population than others. So pollster allows you to kind of create your own average, you know, kind of going through that. So that's one place I turn. But my main interest as a you know, someone who follows all of these polls is looking at the details of the poll. So what you'll get in any of the aggregated sites is kind of the horse race number, and I'm always interested in more than that. And so I look to the individual sources to see what other questions they ask that might help tell the story of this election or understand what's happening, not just say so-and-so is up 2 or down 2 or, you know, 1.5 points. That's just not that useful in terms of understanding what's happening.
I'm speaking with John Cohen, who's the Washington Post polling director. Was there a question in looking at this that, I don't know, struck you as interesting or unusual during this election?
So far, I mean, well, we ask a range of questions. You know, of course, we focused on the economy, which is the overwhelmingly dominant issue. You don't really need a poll to say that, but it's been crystal clear in the data. We ask about, you know, a range of issues, and it's interesting how, although perhaps not surprising, that certain issues pop up for certain groups. You know, we just did a poll in Virginia, which is one of the crucial battleground states that both sides are contesting heavily, and among voters over 50, Medicare is as important as the economy, and, you know, it may be their economy in some sense. So, you know, kind of asking different questions can help you, you know, understand what the meaning behind just a broad, vague term like the economy. So Medicare, healthcare issues, the deficit, you know, it takes that level of detail to understand, you know, what's happening there. I think there's been an interesting interplay in the national tracking data that we started 11 days ago, and that is, you know, Romney had developed a pretty clear advantage head-to-head against the president when it came to handling the economy, and he had actually neutralized what had been a persistent advantage for the president, which was just a better understanding the economic problems that people continue to have. He had neutralized that as of the data that we released this morning. Obama had regained a very slender 5-point advantage on economic empathy, and Romney's advantage on the economy was down to 5. So you have these kind of dueling advantages, one about handling the national economy, and that is, of course, something that majorities of voters for more than 2 years now think that the president has not done a good job on. And when it comes to understanding economic problems, and that's been to the president's advantage basically the entire campaign, you have most voters who say that, you know, Romney would favor the wealthy as president, not the middle class. And that's been a problem for his candidacy. Of course, it's a problem that's led him to a basic tie, as we've seen in our poll and others in the last 2 weeks.
So going back to your five myths about political polls, one thing that we heard a lot in the media was that the first presidential debate really altered Obama's chances to win.
Yes, right. I mean, there was really no data from immediately before the debate to after that pointed to significant movement toward Romney. Of course, I published that piece in the way back of October 12th, and some things have actually changed since then. So I would say that there were two sides of the ledger about whether that first debate made a huge difference. And at the time I was writing, it seemed like there was far more evidence that not much had changed, or if it had changed, it was relatively insignificant. Now I think it's a more even score, and that's just in some of the seeds that were planted in that first debate, including Romney's increasing favorability and more people feeling more negatively about the president following the debate, kind of solidified. And what we see in our tracking data is Romney, as I mentioned, has this advantage on handling the economy. That's not necessarily attributable only to the first debate, but the first debate definitely set in motion a different trajectory.
Well, I know that we've also heard a lot about that Romney got momentum from that turned it around, where all of a sudden he was moving faster forward and his numbers were increasing in support. Is that true according to the polling data?
There are aspects of that are true. I think that there's no question that being on stage with the president, who had been consistently more popular, helped Romney even the score. Far more people said that they felt better about Romney because of his debate performances, and not just the first. I mean, we now have the second and third debates to consider, and when you take all three debates together, more than twice as many voters say they have better feelings about Romney because of his debate performances than worse ones. And so he was able to, essentially become a little bit more popular. And when we asked just last week, do you have a favorable or unfavorable impression of these two candidates, Romney was running about evenly with Obama. That had not been true before. So, again, a lot has happened since the first debate, but the first debate did set things in motion that, have led us back to a basic tie. Of course, we were at a basic tie when we entered the party conventions, and it was really this period in September when Obama appeared to have a quite a large lead, not only nationally in some polls, although not in ours, and in some state polling, where he had significant advantages over Romney in Ohio that both sides think they need to win, Virginia and Florida. And, Obama's leads in those states have dwindled or disappeared, more dwindled than disappeared. And so I think that things have changed, but we were probably always destined for a very competitive election, and that was true several months ago, and it's true right now.
We're talking about how to make sense of the national and state polls that come out each day with John Cohen, the Washington Post polling director. John, private firms, media companies, universities, all these different people are putting out polls, some of them every single day. What happens if they end up being right about what they predicted when the election is actually finished? Does that help them in some way going forward?
Well, they'll certainly put out a press release.
Well, yes.
I think the interesting dynamic we have now is there is pretty wide variation in these polls. Gallup just yesterday had Romney up 5, I believe, among likely voters. There are other firms that are out with Obama plus 3. Now, that 8-point spread on the margin is actually less significant than, or not as big as the one we saw 4 years ago. It's just that there was all the variability was on how big Obama's win was going to be. And, now we have, we'll see what happens over the course of the last final week. But, right now you have, some pollsters on one side of the equation and others on the other. And so I do think that it will be very interesting to see who's on one side or the other when the November 6th comes around. I will point out that, this is not laser surgery. So, whether, our poll, which, our latest release is 49-48 Romney, there's very little difference with a survey that's 49-48 in Obama's favor. It's plus or minus 3.5 percentage points, and that applies to both candidates. I would not write a different story in the Washington Post at 49-48 with Obama at 49 than I do with Romney at 49. It's essentially the same story given a poll, and there are prognosticators who want to kind of take those numbers and suss out who's going to win, and I understand who's going to win is very important to a lot of people in this country. But as far as a poll goes, other than saying something is deadlocked, and the reasons why, and how much lock-in there is, and how few undecideds remain and where independents are going on, whether there's a gender gap, that those stories don't change if you're plus one one way or plus one the other.
And just for one last question, when it comes to the odds versus polling percentages, does that make the numbers less close?
Well, I mean, the odds that are out there, at least the ones I'm familiar with from Nate Silver at 538 and others, you know, kind of have a pretty, you know, sizable advantage for Obama heading into the last. Those are poll-based averages, at least the ones that I'm, you know, I'm familiar with. So they are kind of basing it on the same data. And we're talking about pretty small poll differences that get amplified into pretty large differences in terms of odds. So I think that, yeah, I'm not an odds maker myself. I'm a pollster. So I know that, you know, when we have Obama up 4 in Virginia and having lost an 8-point, what had been an 8-point advantage just a few weeks ago, and he's up 4 and it's a 3.5 air margin, all I know is that's a pretty slender lead. And, you know, if you're betting on it, you know, you'd rather bet on plus 4 than not.
John Cohen is the Washington Post polling director. Thanks so much for taking the time, John.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
What makes us succeed?
I wanted to have the trappings of success.
They were spectacularly wealthy because they were spectacularly lucky.
Having good social savvy has helped me just as much as having book smarts.
Good fortune and who you know.
Where you're born and your parents' education, the color of your skin.
Why we think we're as well off as we are. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 1021. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, performing the world premiere of Far But Close and Contested Space, choreographed by Donald Byrd, November 16th and 17th at the Moore Theater. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
Clouds and showers and a little bit of sunshine in the University District, 55 degrees right now. Forecast calls for a high of 59, rain tapering off to just a chance later today. Chance of showers this evening as well, with the rain picking up overnight, the low in the low 50s. Clouds and rain again tomorrow, the high reaching 57.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Weekday's home repair expert Roger Ferris is also a hazard mitigation community education outreach supervisor for FEMA, and he's been asked to head out today to help out with Hurricane Sandy. So we thought we'd check in with him really briefly before he hits the road. Hi, Roger.
Hello, Katie.
So you've gotten some marching orders. Where will you be heading?
Yes, well, I'm heading for Massachusetts, and I am pleased to have learned that there'll be people from all over the country who are disaster response folks who are heading in that general direction toward the east to do whatever can be done to help prevent damage, prevent more damage, and help communities recover.
Well, how do you, maybe just nitty-gritty, tell us what you'll be doing there.
Well, when I get there, the FEMA rule is stay flexible because I will be asked to do whatever is needed most urgently, and that's how we always do things early on in a disaster. So I have no idea what my first duties will be. Eventually, I will revert to the role of helping people understand ways to prevent future damage. But during and immediately after a storm, there are some things that people can do to prevent ongoing damage. Just keep the damage to as minimum as possible, and so I'm sure I'll be, you know, working in that realm to begin with.
What are some of those things? Like, give me an example of something you might tell someone.
Life safety issues during a storm include, you know, providing quality information about staying safe. And in a hurricane and this is expected to be hurricane force winds for over 500 miles along the coast, there'll be a real emphasis on finding a safe place to shelter and staying inside. The East Coast has an amazing number of beautiful tall trees, and it's not safe to go outside during a storm and have those come crashing down. So then, you know, the utility safety, how to be safe around gas lines, electrical, It's really important that people do the right thing during and immediately after the storm. And you know, in a storm, you really do want to unplug electronic devices and that kind of thing to have them avoid being fried by the surge that happens when power goes out.
Well, and finally, Roger, how do you feel about going?
Well, I'm excited. I really want to be there to help, and that's how we all feel about these disasters. We get a feeling that, you know, we sometimes are able to do something that really makes a difference, and this is just a huge opportunity for all the disaster workers to go and take part in this. The organization, FEMA, is very well organized now. It's got great leadership, and we're ready to be effective from the moment we arrive, so I feel really good about it.
Weekdays Home Repair expert Roger Ferris is heading off in his role as Hazard Mitigation Community Education Outreach Supervisor for FEMA. You're heading out today, huh, Roger?
Yes, and for people who have friends and relatives back there, you know, be sure to have them get in touch with the local Red Cross or the National Red Cross through the website to look over all of the quality advice. Both FEMA.gov and American Red Cross have amazingly good online publications and hard copies, if you can get hold of one, about what to do before, during, and after a storm.
All right. Thanks, Roger. Have a good trip. Let us know how you're doing over there.
Thank you. I sure will.
All right. Thanks. That's music you're listening to from an 1878 recording made by a Thomas Edison phonograph. Scientists at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory have been restoring that recording. It's thought to be the oldest documentation of an American voice and music ever deciphered. It's from a piece of tinfoil that was at the Schenectady Museum of Innovation and Science. It was digitally encoded so we could hear the recording today. And joining us to talk about how it was done and what to make of that recording is Carl Haber. He's the senior scientist in the physics division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Library. Thanks for joining us, Carl.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
So how was that recording made? Can you explain the technology?
You mean originally?
Originally, yes.
Right. So what Edison did is he had a device which he called the phonograph, and it consisted of a metal cylinder which he could rotate, and it was on a screw, so the cylinder, as he rotated it, the cylinder would move. And he wrapped it with tin foil, and then he had a little horn, a small little horn, with a diaphragm that would vibrate at the base of the horn that was connected to a needle, a point. And he put that point in contact with the foil, and then as he spoke or as anybody spoke or played music, the foil would vibrate, causing the stylus to move deeper into the foil, and as the foil moved, it would emboss the pattern that corresponded to the sound. And then to play it back, he essentially reversed the process and let the foil then drive the diaphragm, which caused the air to pick up the vibrations, and then if your ear was nearby, you'd hear it.
Now, it's my understanding that Edison actually sold this machine. Is that true?
Correct. So he demonstrated his invention in late 1877, and by early 1878, they were actually selling exhibition phonographs. And The particular one that recorded the foil that you just played was sold to a Mr. Thomas Mason in St. Louis, and it's recorded in the records of the Edison Company, and it was sold for $95, which would have been a lot of money in those days. And there were quite a number of those sold by 1878, and people were basically demonstrating them around the country.
Were they mainly purchased just for the novelty of it, or were people using the recordings for anything in particular?
I think at that point it was pretty much a novelty. You would do a demonstration. I don't know if they would charge for people to come in and hear it, but it was this amazing thing that a machine could speak. We take that for granted, obviously, today.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine in 1878 that never hearing something like that before, and suddenly he's turning a crank and it's talking back.
So how did this recording happen to survive all these years? What, 134 years?
Yes. So the recording was in the possession of a collector who basically held it for many years, and it was folded up. There were seven folds in it, and it was put in an envelope. And the envelope was, I think, provided at the time, because the museum still has the envelope, and it says, Exhibition of Edison Phonograph in St. Louis, and the date, and so forth. And he held it for many years, and then it was passed on to his daughter, who ended up in Connecticut. And in 1978, which is actually 100 years after it was recorded, she gave it to the Schenectady Museum, which is now the Museum of Innovation and Science. And then they've held on to it since 1978.
So let's talk about the modern process that you went through. How do you go about restoring a recording that's this old and that has been in an envelope for over 100 years?
Okay. So at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, we have a project which has been going on for some years now to look at these early recordings. So not just the tinfoil, but there's a whole number of recordings from the 19th century and early 20th century. And we've been working on this project very, very closely with the Library of Congress, which is kind of takes a national leadership role in issues of this sort. And what we've done is we said, something of this sort, you can't touch it with a needle again because it would be destroyed. And so we've taken a bunch of techniques based on optics, based on using reflected light, and we've found a number of techniques where you can reflect light off the surface of these things, but very, very precisely, and effectively take a picture of them. But it's a very, very detailed picture. If we measured it in pixels, it would be 4 gigapixels, and it has all the information in it about the structure of the surface. It's more than just a photograph because we actually have all three dimensions in the picture, and we take this picture on the computer, and then we have an algorithm of basically a computer program that calculates what the needle would do if you were to play it back rather than actually play it back. So it's essentially played back by a virtual phonograph, and by tracking the motion of the needle, you can apply a little bit of physics and you can calculate what the sound would have been. And result is what you've just been playing a moment ago.
Wow, that's really incredible. what was it like to hear the recording for the first time after going through that?
Well, we've had this experience a few times because, mm-hmm. as you said, we've looked at a number of recordings from the 19th century. But it's always very, very exciting because, first of all, you don't actually know what they're going to say and what they're going to sound like, and it's amazing because it's like a voice from such a long time ago, and it's coming directly to you through the speaker. So it's an amazing jump in time, the interesting thing is the range of recordings that we looked at, they're always different. Sometimes they make funny sounds. Sometimes it's spontaneous. Other times it's clearly very, very posed or rehearsed. This one was an interesting combination because there's laughter in there. Some people have said that the individual made a mistake and then started laughing at himself. So they refer to this as the first blooper. There's music, which is the first time we've ever heard instrumental music, musical instruments played on any of these 19th century recordings that we've looked at from this experimental period. There's the kind of iconic nursery rhymes. Edison apparently said Mary Had a Little Lamb the very first time he recorded anything, so people are always saying Mary Had a Little Lamb. But this one was interesting because it was such a combination. So it was, very exciting to hear it for the first time.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the voice talking on the recording and the laughter you were talking about. Is there something about the fact that he's laughing and seems to be improvisational that makes this a different kind of recording for you? A more interesting artifact, perhaps?
Well, I don't know. They're all interesting. You know, there's one that we restored and presented a year ago, which was recorded in Alexander Graham Bell's laboratory just a few years after this one, where it's clear that something went wrong and they actually, you know, utter a profanity. So there's always something unexpected. I mean, it's so diverse what they thought to put on these things. And also, as a scientist, it's very fascinating to think, you know, these people were, at least the ones that were doing experiments, I mean, they were thinking technically. And one of the things we found that you often hear on these early recordings is a trill, you know, a kind of brrrrup sound, which they somehow thought of as a good standard sound that they could compare from one recording to another.
Hmm.
So they were struggling, you know, to find tools that could allow them to get some kind of a comparison that would be somewhat objective. It's a great window on what people were thinking in the 19th century. I mean, this man was thinking about, you know, an exhibition. But a lot of the recordings that you hear from that period, I mean, they were thinking about science and technology because they were trying to work out an invention. And it's fascinating to think what would a sort of technically minded person think to do in the 19th century as a test, as a way of understanding if they had a good invention or if it was improved or not.
I'm speaking with Carl Haber. He's the senior scientist in the physics division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and we're talking about an 1878 recording that they were able to restore, on a recording that was made on the Thomas Edison phonograph. Let's just touch briefly on who the man that was recording himself was. Do you know who it is?
So the curator at my side, Museum in Schenectady, Chris Hunter, has done a lot of research and tried to, you know, kind of fill in the backstory here. And he went and found microfilms of the St. Louis newspapers of the day. And he actually found an announcement in the newspaper about the exhibition of this machine at a certain date and time in a certain place. And so there's actually a lot of information now. And as I said, the man who did the recording was named Thomas Mason. He was a journalist, and he used the pen name I.X.PECT, which would have been pronounced I expect. And apparently he was a humor writer, and so that's the whimsical aspect. And the other thing which, sadly, Chris uncovered was that a few days after this recording was made, it was a heat wave, and unfortunately, he passed away. So it's one of those unique stories that you basically unearth when you go in and try and find this. So as best Chris Hunter can determine, that's the story.
Well, it's interesting, too, because reading about his life and hearing his voice, you have a pang of sadness to find out that he died so shortly after making that recording. Is there something about having the recording of somebody's voice that somehow, I don't know, makes you feel differently about them versus maybe if we had a stack of his humor articles sitting here right now?
I think people will say that when you hear a voice, it somehow, even if it's degraded or there's a lot of noise over it, there's a sense of the humanity of the person that comes right into you by listening to it. If you closed your eyes, you know, you could convince yourself that maybe you were actually listening to a live human being. Obviously, we wouldn't say that given the state of this recording, but there is something very powerful about sound. When we look at a picture, it's clear, you know, we're looking into the plane of a piece of paper or a screen. But with sound, it's different. It's coming into the room. And so I can't speak for everyone, but I think there is something special about hearing that man's voice.
Is that why you do this type of restoration work?
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. I mean, we do this restoration work because we think that science and technology can help, you know, preserve the technical, cultural, artistic, historical artifacts of the past. And it's, you know, I think it's important to try to make a contribution to maintaining our history. And there's a lot of reasons to do that. One of them could be this emotional reason that you were referring to. But, I mean, there's so much to learn from the way things were worked out and how people's ideas developed that kind of inform our society today. And, you know, they're not making more of these artifacts. They're not making more early recorded sound. So we have to find a way to preserve motion pictures, images, recorded sound, all of the artifacts that our culture has produced for various reasons. It's important to find a way to preserve and create access to as many of them as we can. And, you know, that's why the Library of Congress and, you know, the agencies that support these things do that. It's our heritage and our culture across a broad range of areas.
Carl Haber is a senior scientist in the physics division at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Thanks so much for taking the time, Carl.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Weekday.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine, 57 degrees right now in the University District. Forecast calls for a chance of showers the rest of today, the high getting up to 59. Chance of rain this evening, with rain increasing overnight, the low in the low 50s. Clouds and rain expected tomorrow, the high reaching 57.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
This week on Selected Shorts.
Tear up the planks! Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart!
I'm Neil Gaiman. Please join us for some classics from Edgar Allan Poe. From PRI, Public Radio International.
And that comes your way tomorrow night at 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the Paradise Theater School, presenting Rosebud, The Lives of Orson Welles, a solo performance about artistic renegade and film director Orson Welles, playing November 29th through December 15th at West of Lennon in Fremont. Tickets are available at brownpapertickets.com.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Now we gather around the virtual radio water cooler to discuss the buzz of the day, which, as we woke up this morning, the buzz of the day is the big, huge storm that's about to hit the East Coast. So we're going to start there. We'll also touch on the election. And we probably need to mention Halloween, right? It is going on. It's not just the election. We are preparing for the holidays. So all that we will be tackling all those things with Garth Stein, the author of the New York Times bestselling novel, The Art of Racing in the Rain, also a former race car driver. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And Valerie Curtis Newton, who's the head of performance at the UW School of Drama. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about big storms. Valerie, have you ever been caught in a really big storm?
Actually, living in New England, a couple of them. There was a huge blizzard in 1978, I think it was, that shut down Massachusetts and Connecticut, and we had martial law. It worked out to be sort of cool because I was at college, so we built, you know, snow sculptures and put kegs in them to keep it cold. But fortunately, the dining hall still had food and we could be out on campus. But, you know, in New England, we suffered a lot from ice storms. So the roads would be too icy to drive and the power lines would come down. And you just had to, you know, have your bathtub full and some way to cook. And you just got it out until everything thawed.
Was there a certain fun to it? Sounds like you guys had a pretty good time.
It was beautiful. I mean, like in a weird way, the ice storms were beautiful. You'd look outside and everything sort of glistened and sparkled, and when you're a kid, that's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely can, now that living far away, I have a sense of, you know, anxiety about what's going on with my people back east, and is everybody battened down the hatches? Is the bathtub full? Is there water in the house?
Right.
That sort of stuff.
How about you, Garth?
I lived in New York for 18 years, and the hurricanes come, and there's always the buildup for it, and then people would tape their windows. And then it would inevitably miss the city. There was a big storm 15 years ago. I was around the other water cooler that doesn't have the microphones. I was telling Valerie, my in-laws have a place out on Eastern Long Island, and it was right up on the dunes, and they actually, it was encroaching. The big hurricane came, and they had to move their house, pick it up and put it on roller logs and roll it back 200 yards. And that whole dune went. So the erosion gets really nasty out there in Long Island.
Did you find that people were heeding the warnings a lot of times when you'd get these storm warnings and then nothing would happen, and then you'd get another one, nothing would happen?
I think that, in the cities where there's a lot of, we got to get the work done. We have to do our business. And I really think it was probably, since it does seem to be hitting, probably one of the smartest things for Bloomberg to do is shut down the subways and the transit system. Because as long as they're going, people are going to try and be troopers. And we lived through a summer fluke rainstorm in New York, I remember 12 years ago or so. And, 3 inches of rain in 20 minutes kind of thing. And it totally flooded out the subways. And it was a real disaster. And, people can die. So I think that it's good that the authorities are taking charge of this, you know.
What is it like for, I assume all of us know people who are living on the East Coast that are in the hit zone of this. How does it make you feel to be so far away?
It's tough. It is tough. My wife and I, on the way in, we were just talking to our parents back east. And, they're older, and there's tremendous concerns about the trees around the houses and what's going to happen without electricity. And so there's all that stuff is really, but then there's the other part of it, which is they've also lived through a bunch of stuff,
Mm-hmm.
It's like when I was in New Orleans just before Hurricane Katrina and they were beginning to evacuate, there were people who were like, I was here back when Irene struck and I'm not going. And so I think that Katrina has made everybody more willing to take these things very, very, very seriously.
Can we keep in mind also that there was a 7.7 level earthquake off the coast of Canada, and there were a couple of earthquakes down in California just the other day?
One in Arkansas and one in Maine.
everybody should be, taking this seriously.
Mother Earth
seriously.
Is not happy.
Yeah, exactly. Gaia is underway, and maybe we really should get our bottled water and bolt our houses to our foundations here, because we can look and say, oh, look, over on the East Coast, they're dealing with these problems.
Absolutely.
We don't have hurricanes. We don't have that. We don't have tornadoes. We don't have all this, but yikes.
We do have the earthquake. Yeah.
Our earth move.
Our producer Amina was saying this morning that maybe that means that we are going to avoid an earthquake if they're happening all around us. And I told her the sad news that that's not scientifically true.
No, we would then be the pinch point.
Yeah. Sorry, Amina. Poor Amina. Let's move on to the election, because we don't have a ton of time. But it feels like it's been going on forever at this point. For the first time that I can remember, I'm talking to reporters who are covering it who are sick to death of this election.
It's just awful.
But why do you think people are being so exhausted by this election? Is this one different than others?
I think that we're so overwhelmed with information that it feels like we should be paying attention to everything, and that's exhausting. Needing to do your own research, then having a lot of information sort of spewed on you from every single kind of form that you can imagine. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is that that we encourage people have been encouraged by the need to raise money to run all the time. Like, you sort of have to begin running 4 or 5 years before you're going to run. And I think that it's incessant. Mm-hmm. The campaigning is incessant.
It's really, and it's the sheer money is just really depressing. That it's this Citizens United thing, I think, has really made it so prevalent in all the airwaves. I mean, I did a swing through the East Coast a couple weeks ago, and so I hit. I was in Philadelphia, so I was in Pennsylvania, and I was in Virginia, and I was in Connecticut, and we hardly see anything here compared to what it was. I mean, it is. You can't step outside the hotel without being barraged with media and just ads and radio ads and billboards and everything. It's just it's so negative and it's so nasty, and it's like, enough already. I'm glad I already voted. So I can walk around now to all the people say, no, sorry, you can't change my – if you were saving your money for the last week, it doesn't affect me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One thing I did learn is that if you do vote early, you will no longer get junk mail advertising in your mail. So that's a reason to do it, right? Well, if there's so much information, then why are there still undecided voters?
Because the information is – a lot of it's misinformation and lies. And the way that we get our news, because we can sort of tune into the people who are going to tell us what we want to hear, whether it's true or it's not true, I think that people get bad information and never have it challenged.
What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of it, is that we don't know who to trust anymore, and everybody seems kind of untrustworthy. And so the safest thing to do is just hang back and hope for some sort of greater truth to come out of it. But I'm not sure there's much holding out hope for any greater truth. I mean, you know, the flip side of it would be that maybe the undecideds are just feeling neglected in other parts of their lives, and they want the attention, because we talk all the time about the undecideds. And so therefore, if you say, well, I'm still undecided, then a lot of attention is being focused on you.
Well, and I think that there is a difference between the undecided voters and the uninformed voters. I think that there are lots of voters who have decided who are still uninformed.
Mm-hmm.
The undecided voters, I think that we have as a country, have a desire to be on the winning side. And I think that there's an element of waiting to have a sense of, you know, which side is going to win. And there's some element of our culture, I think, that just wants to win.
That's an interesting idea. We're talking about the buzz of the day with Valerie Curtis Newton, who's the head of performance at the UW School of Drama, and Garth Stein, who's the author of the New York Times bestselling novel, The Art of Racing in the Rain. Well, you mentioned that it has this increasingly negative tone. I don't think any of us don't know that by now. Do you think it, or do you see any evidence of it affecting our behavior toward one another?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
How so?
I think that we've seen it coming. We've seen the sort of the tide of incivility rising. We can't actually talk about how we want to be governed without devolving into acrimony. And that's become the way that we function every day. You know, I think that there is this language about victims and about the people who do the work versus the people who don't do the work, the thems versus the us's. You know, the reason that Chris Matthews was going crazy for a month and a half on his TV show was the language around the president as other. And similarly, Republicans going off about language about Mitt Romney being dangerous. There's a level of hyperbole right now that is just sort of, it's disgusting, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't listen to it over time at that level and go, this is all, you know, nonsense.
And I think that some of it has to do with this increasing sort of atmosphere of a lack of common courtesy that I think is being perpetuated. I hate to say this because that'll make me sound whatever, but by the internet. I mean, we feel insulated from, we feel able that we can say anything we want to people through email and through Facebook and through social media and stuff. And we forget that people have feelings. I mean, I get emails from people about my book or something, and they'll be vicious. I mean, vicious. And I email them back and I say, can't you just be pleasant? You don't have to like it, but can't you just be pleasant about it? And then they say, oh, I didn't realize you were actually going to read it. And so I think that a lot of that goes on with Facebook stuff where they, I mean, people do such nasty things with cartoons about Romney and Obama that are really disrespectful and really nasty. And I don't think that people understand that not only are the candidates human beings, but the people who are their proponents are human beings, and there's a real offense taken. There's just no respect for people anymore.
And we sort of have mystified or ill-defined what it is to be gracious, what it is to be compassionate, what it is to actually hear the opposition. And we mistake that stridency for sort of conviction. If I can really call you out in really, you know, aggressive language, then that means I'm more convicted of my principles than you are. Mm-hmm. And we see that on television every day from 5 to 8.
Right.
It's empathy. I mean, there's a lack of empathy. We're losing our empathy, really, as a society. And it's terrible. People should read more books and see more plays, because that will make you more empathetic.
Do you have a sense of why people write you such scathing emails? Like, if they think that you're not actually going to read them, then what's the point?
Good question. I guess that they want to air their views, and they figure that, again, with the conviction idea, that they think that if they say it in a particularly spiteful or cruel way, they will somehow be more legitimized in their conviction. And, you know, look, again, no one has to like everything, and no one has to vote for everybody. You pick your candidate. But can't we be civil about the discourse? Where is our civility? The ads that are going, did you see the article in the paper about the billboards and all this kind of stuff in Florida, and these DVDs that are going around? Yeah. 4 million copies of the DVDs. And gee, the Republican Party has no idea where all that stuff came from. But it's this nasty, nasty stuff. And where is the civility?
Well, how do we dial that back, do you think, Valerie? Is there hope, or is this just the road we're heading on?
You know, Matt Dowd wrote a great article about the need for a Camp David-like peace talks among various sections of American culture, because I've said this before, the way in which we are sort of ungovernable because of these attitudes and the lack of ability to actually both hear, listen, you know, hear, and then find common ground. The common ground has become a really, really it's like a micro island in the Pacific, you know, like of all the landmass in the world, we've got a micro island of common ground, and we've got to do better as a country. We just have got to do better.
Do you see a hope of how we could turn it around?
I'm becoming really cynical about money, and it's all politics is all money now. And I don't think it's going to tone down, because there's too much at stake for large corporations that have a vested interest in a certain agenda. And now the floodgates are opened, and there's ridiculous amounts of how many billions of dollars are being spent now. Could we like improve our education system with those billions and take away the ads? I mean, please. Really? It's just so frustrating. I want to go out there and do something. I want to activate. Come on. Come on, people. Join me today at noon somewhere.
Well, when you get that plan together, let us know. Okay?
Yeah, we're going to have it. Probably the Columbia City Ale House or something.
So I left you all of 30 seconds to tell me. Halloween, is it something that you like to participate in, Valerie?
Not so much.
No? No costume this year?
No costume this year. I have in the past done a little drag on Halloween, but this Halloween, my neighborhood suddenly has a lot of children. Mm. And so I'm going to actually be at home handing out candy, if in fact they wear costumes, and the older children who try to sneak by with the pillow, you know, I make them sing a song or tell a joke or something. I got to get something in exchange for the candy.
I like that. How about you, Garth?
Yeah, no, I only do it from a dad's point. My youngest son is 5, and so he's like in the sweet spot of Halloween. So
what's he going as?
I think he's some sort of a Power Ranger, I believe. I'm not sure. he's just...
You better get that together. You don't have very much time.
He knows. He has a lot of costumes at home.
Oh, that's good. Garth Stein is the author of the New York Times bestselling novel, The Art of Racing in the Rain. And Valerie Curtis Newton is the head of performance at the UW School of Drama. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Katie Sewell. Weekdays produced by Jason Pagano, Brian Buckaloo, Amina Alsadi. Our interns are Alexander Garrettin and Danielle Anthony Goodwin. And Andy Hurst is our engineer. I'm Katie Sewell, filling in for Steve. Until tomorrow, thanks a lot.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay with us.
Support for KUOW comes from the ACLU of Washington. Celebrating 77 years of protecting liberty in Washington State, the Bill of Rights Dinner welcomes political journalist and author Glenn Greenwald. November 10th at the Seattle Waterfront Marriott. Tickets at aclu-wa.org.
KUOW welcomes Stuart McLean and the Vinyl Cafe back to Seattle on Friday, December 14th at the Paramount Theater as part of their Christmas concert tour. For information, visit our events page at KUOW.org.
You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.